Hi, this is John Stone from 10,000 Blades, and you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, streaming live at newhavenindependent.org. All the best of food and drink, a glass of wine, a smile, a wink. Don't have a cow, don't make a stink, it's Lucy in the kitchen sink.
Took a trip with some unknown demon on the road on the right side of town. He said, doesn't it seem like we could dream our way to new ground? He said, doesn't it seem like the same titled about Steven here forever, chatting about the weather and ignoring the folks that don't fit. So I followed this demon, his name was Barbados. He told me he could see all time. Then the animals told me that he was not lying, and I thought I was losing my mind. So he taught me his power, told me never to use it, burned a tree trunk just for fun. Then we crept down a staircase, through a mossy tunnel, far down away from the sun. He said, I've seen heaven in the other place, I can't wait to see the look upon your face when you realize it's all here on earth. But well, there's no reason I can't see for you not to shape your reality, make your treasure, name it worth. After 3 days' travel, we made our way to a breathtaking place. There were people of all shapes and sizes, running wild without disgrace. Oh, the demon had said that some powerful woman had hidden her treasure, marked it with a feather, and to find it was to help us to bring about change. Could get what we wanted, but back when confronted, ignore it if we wanted to. Well, there's nothing you could ever say, and little you could ever sing to be cast to the current through. Well, I tried to thank him for bringing me to this village where I could hide among the corn. He wouldn't hear me, he said he grew weary, he had a lot to help us learn. He said, I've seen heaven in the other place, I can't wait to see the look upon your face when you realize it's all here on earth. Well, there's no reason I can see for you not to shape your reality, make your treasure, name it's worth. And he said, I've seen heaven in the other place, I can't wait to see the look upon your face when you realize it's all here on earth. Well, there's no reason I can see for you not to shape your reality, make your treasure, name it's worth.
Hey, New Haveners, and welcome back to another episode of Kitchen Sink. Those sounds you heard at the top of the hour were musician Adam Matlock, playing live in the WNHH studio as we eased into a pre-recording session earlier this week. Adam is currently a member of four ensembles, but has belonged to several more at any given time. To date, he has released three albums, Small Mercies, under the name Anhistoric, Solstice, under the name Nahadoth, and Lung Fiddle, under his own name. The plan in the studio was this: to have him play five songs and share five recipes, which is an amusing and unplanned and very unfood schmoozy thing I started to do earlier this year with Mercy Choir frontman Paul Balbusty. What happened instead was the most fun, definitely non-linear, and slightly random interview I've done in a long time. I've edited it a little for clarity and length, but sincerely hope that you enjoy the digressions as much as I did. Adam, I want to get right into it and talk about the first song that you played us in with.
Okay, that's a song I wrote it a very long time ago now, called The Duke Barbados. And it's sort of a story about a figure that appears in medieval occult literature, who's like a demon. But, you know, back in those days, things were, I guess, a little more complex. And so there were lots of like Christian magicians who were summoning demons in order to figure out, you know, accomplish their goals and such. So I was really fascinated by that kind of that whole sort of framework, which is much different than the way religious framework tends to be these days. And so that was the story kind of came out of that a little bit.
Okay, so we're going to back up. I tend to do a lot of like going back to go forward, and I don't know if that's a good thing, but it's just how I roll.
That's fine. Yeah.
And so I'm curious, like, how did you find this story? Let's start there.
When I was in college, I met some people who were, and was pretty good friends with some people who were, you know, sort of identified in some way as sort of like, you know, wizards, mystics, occultists of some kind. So, you know, it was mostly by being connected, to them that I figured out that there was like this whole wealth of literature out there besides just, you know, heavy metal lyrics and whatnot. Cause that was a big part of what I was doing in high school, but you know, a lot of that stuff is just for shock value. And there's, you know, this whole kind of other tradition, which, has always kind of fascinated with me, even if I, you know, not always sure what to make of it, but the writing about it's really interesting.
So let's talk about how you got into music and the accordion specifically, because it's not an instrument that you hear about all the time. I think a lot of kids pick up the clarinet, maybe they pick up the flute. Fewer kids pick up, for instance, the French horn, the accordion. Mm-hmm. And so what drew you to it and when?
I started out playing piano when I was young, as that was much more common beginning instrument. And I basically went through this whole course of classical piano instruction until somewhere in the middle of high school, got really interested in jazz, failed to sort of jump disciplines properly, and just spent a lot of time kind of playing in rock bands. And at some point when I wasn't really sure that I was going to keep doing music as a kind of regular thing, I had a roommate in college that convinced me to join a klezmer ensemble, with her. And so I joined this klezmer ensemble, and, the teacher, of that ensemble was carried an accordion around in her car at all times. And that was how it all began. So
when you say rock bands, you've also said you were into metal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining you're an incredibly mild mannered dude. So I'm trying to imagine like this metal Adam Matlock walking around. Did you go for the whole ensemble? Like
I was a little I was a little goth, a little. I had very sensible parents, my mom especially, and so you know most of my black wardrobe kind of disappeared. I hate to say it, but like pretty shortly after like the school shootings, Columbine and stuff started happening. When you know the trench coat mafia like was a big buzzword in the news, and I was sort of just starting to become aware of this, like, and you know people were really up in arms about media violence and song lyrics and things like that. That's when. All of the black trench coat of mine disappeared out of my closet. And so it was all in my head.
So you're growing up and you're ultimately watching this, sort of leadership figure, mentor figure carrying an accordion around. And was it just like, oh, I want to do that?
For when I was growing up, like the only accordion that I really knew about, was Al Yankovic, and it was good for novelty. I didn't really think of it as a serious instrument.
And people don't think of him as a serious musician,
which is of course not true. Like he's,
right.
You know, he's got some chops, but yes, I mean, that's anyway, but that's a whole other conversation.
And then the parallel exposure, cause I want to get into talking about,
sort of the value of experimentation, certainly with instruments, but also with food. So growing up, were you in the kitchen a lot as a kid?
I was famously clumsy in the kitchen for a very long time. Once I started, I was 12 or 13 and started having cable in my room.
Ooh.
And so I started watching cooking shows, Iron Chef, things like that, especially Iron Chef. That was like the big deal for me because I was a Japanophile, to put it mildly. So I was really into that kind of stuff and like this whole competitive cooking and making it looking flashy and everything like that. And at that point I just sort of started fancying myself a cook. Trying to cook things without really any direction or guidance, except for from my parents who didn't want to eat, like a totally overcooked chicken breast or anything like that. So that was really like, the height of my ambitions was just trying to replicate things like that.
That's really
funny. My high school had a couple of cooking classes, so I took a few of those. And that was probably the height of my ability of following recipes was in those classes.
Was that also in your goth day? Now I'm trying to imagine goth
beyond
Adam Matlock, like frying an egg or something like that.
They didn't quite overlap.
So of course, at some point, this leads me to asking him not just about music, but about a recipe itself, which was one of the kooky ideas behind the show.
So let's actually talk about improvisation, because I also want to bring sort of the food part in here. And what I loved was when we were kind of going back and forth and talking about, would you come on the show? One of the things you said was, well, I don't think I have any recipes written down. And I love that. I mean, for me, that's like, it's a very good sign. And I know among some friends of mine who are musicians, Brian Slattery, who we both know, who's mm-hmm. a host here at WNHH and the arts editor at the New Haven Independent, cooks a lot. And I don't think he's ever referred to a recipe. So, I mean, do you think that that's sort of in the wheelhouse of being a musician?
I know a lot of musicians who are terrified of the prospect of improvisation. So I think it's an extension of who you are as a person. And that's one area where it shows up.
And then as far as improvising and getting into the kitchen, so I've asked you to bring some recipes. The show is just like a mishmash of two things that a lot of people like. And so I'm wondering if you can start telling me about one of those recipes.
Sure. Okay. Well, so I've always had an affinity for Ethiopian food ever since I was very young. And so I was born in Germany. And long story short, my parents' landlord's wife was an Eritrean immigrant. And so she learned very early on. And so, we were exposed to this food, to injera, to the various stews and things like that. And of course, there are lots of differences between how Eritreans present the food and how Ethiopians do, but there's a lot of overlap too. And so when I got older and started really cooking on a more regular basis, and this was, around when I was in college, I learned a little bit more about how injera is traditionally made. Usually it uses this grain called teff, which is, very, very hot, highly sought after for people with gluten sensitivities now. It's a, really high protein grain. And, if you go and eat at Lalibela, like that's one of the things that makes their injera really distinctive and kind of tangy and sour is this particular grain. But of course they didn't have this in Germany in the 80s, West Germany in the 80s. So in order to kind of get something similar to that flavor when making injera, like people in this community would use self-rising flour and a can of cheap beer to sour it.
That's so interesting.
And so when I was asking my mom, like how she made it, how she'd learned to make it, cause she had made it, ever since we moved back to the States. And like, that was sort of my main way of getting this style of food was, her kind of keeping this tradition alive and, a couple times a year because it takes a lot of work. But she finally, told me that was their workaround was, when you don't have access to the fancy traditional grain that you can just use a can of cheap beer and white flour and just make the injera that way. And it's a pretty good analog, in terms of flavor at least. So
wait, I'm so curious. I have so many questions.
Okay.
So do you let it ferment? Like, do you mix them in a bowl and then do you let it ferment?
So I guess traditionally that would be how it is done. And so but when she did it, it would sit for maybe an hour at most, because she didn't like it to be, my mom doesn't like it to be too sour. So, every time I've made it with her and like used teff, it's usually a little too pungent for her. But yeah, so, right off the bat, like this kind of mode of improvisation was introduced to me as like, a totally legitimate way of doing things. And, at the time I was just getting into fermentation, into sourdough and things like that. So I kind of turned my nose up at it and was like, oh, I think I'll just, use my starter and, ferment it properly and blah, blah, blah. And it took a long time for me to realize to just try the way that I was taught. So that was a process.
And does the beer, so injera is like kind of sticky, it's a little bit gluey, and then tangy, very, very tangy. Mm-hmm. But does the beer with the flour give it that same sticky kind of sticky, almost stretchy consistency?
It's not as much of that. And I think that has to do with the fermentation.
Yeah.
So my understanding, very minimal understanding of what happens when flour and water is fermented is that it develops gluten to some degree, and that that helps to like add to the strength of a bread product, and so yeah, doing it this kind of shorter way, is the same with soda bread versus like a real sourdough
right.
bread. It's like it's a little bit more crumbly, a little bit more pancakey, it has this kind of like soda sweetness that's a little strange, but it's a good analog for
right, and that's the buttermilk and the baking soda. So but definitely in cooking,
mm-hmm.
have you ever been inspired by something you've done or something that's happened in the kitchen to write something, or has food ever informed that? I know that probably your time in Germany has come back to inform that, perhaps.
A little bit. I mean, my parents moved back when I was four, so my memory of German food is limited almost entirely to the sense memory of salami in the kindergarten, the preschool that I attended. So I have this like really strong, and every time I smell this particular like, hardcore German like process. I mean, it's because it's not processed in the same way that American lunch meat like deli meat is. But so there's just like there's a real, I can't describe it at all, but I would know it instantly if I smelled it. So
it's like a sausage.
Yeah, I mean, it's more like, like a slice of like bologna or something
yeah.
like that.
And then we got back into music and food eventually.
So this next one that I'm going to perform is kind of a protest song that I was I wrote for a prompt at Best Video in February of this year, getting a bunch of area musicians, not just the New Haven area, but kind of all over Southern Connecticut, to both cover a protest song and write an original one. And so this was, I basically almost forgot that I had to write an original one. And so then 3 days before the show, looked more closely at the email and suddenly had to produce this one, and it came out pretty well, I think. So fight to a standstill, fight till you can no longer stand. It's what they expected, we're playing right into their hands. That's how it seems sometimes. And cherish the struggle, make some time to mourn the dead, but keep me informed when your slogans start becoming bread. Make sure we eat sometime. This motion brings gnosis, I hope this, but I wonder what happens if I register my protest and hope that it forms a shield. Wrap the signature so tight around me and hope that it keeps my body intact in the weight of the oncoming wheel. But if I'm crushed when I'm alone, I hope that my bones will pierce the tires. Every chapter and every part of this great debate is a question of tactics. Like, who should we first defenestrate? I've got an idea in mind. The struggles are many. Not one of them can be erased. But if we agree that Nazis should be punched in the face, then we'll get along just fine. We're an ocean of voices, and the future is shaped by our choices. Now I barely recognize me. I can't describe how I feel in this company of strangers. I know we can keep our bodies intact in the weight of the oncoming wheel, but if I'm crushed when I'm alone, I hope that my bones will pierce the tires. But if I'm crushed when I'm alone, I hope that my bones will pierce the tires. Thank you.
Oh, I love that. I have so many questions about that one, too. Actually, not that many questions, so much as like thinly veiled political statements. But
okay.
So I won't have to ask why you wrote it, because you were writing it for this this concert at Best Video,
yep.
Which, if I recall correctly, was called Should We Talk About the Government?
Yes. Which I think is a reference to a song lyric,
yes.
But I wasn't sure what the song was.
Yeah, and so there's this illustrious history in music of, you know, bringing politics into songs and mm-hmm. into songwriting. And what song did you cover?
I covered a song by the songwriter Peter Hamill, who's somebody who I've kind of apprenticed myself to over the course of the last 10 or so years. He's mostly not a political songwriter. His work, as you know, in his early 20s was like very like Sturm und Drang, like super dramatic, existential, all that stuff. And and as he got a little bit older, started doing a few more topical songs to varying levels of success. But his song was called The Old School Tie, which was kind of about nepotism in the government and, you know, how like politicians are not really to be trusted because they just want your vote. So, basic, pretty simple stuff, but he uses a lot of interesting turns of phrase in order to bring it in. And that's like a British connection, referring to like boarding schools, prep schools.
And then when you sat down to write this piece, so you had 3 days, 72 hours, however you choose to cut it. You know, what was going through your head? So even in February, I would say now we'll be in September when the show runs.
Okay.
And we're pre-recording in late August, but it's already been a pretty politically tumultuous year. I think everyone, people on both sides of the political spectrum can at least agree on that much.
Yeah.
But even in February, when you wrote this song, it had already been a little bit of a tumultuous year. You know, I think from November 2016 on, people were mobilizing. People had a lot of questions. Folks were angry. And as you sang in the song, you know, Nazis did get punched in the face. I sort of had that image of Richard Spencer going out on loop in my head as you were singing. So what was going through your head as you were writing this piece?
Well, I guess I was being a big grump because I am, you know, obviously, well, I don't know if it's obvious, but anyway, I probably swing further to the left than many people, just in for various reasons that don't need to get into here. But I mean, like, the thing that I had started already to become cynical of during the whole election cycle, and especially since November 7th, that dark day was, November 8th, I guess.
It's all a blur, Adam.
Yeah, I know. But ever, ever since that point, I had become very cynical of the kind of East Coast liberal response, which was to, you know, I mean, because you know, I don't know, there's no point in like pointing fingers at this stage, but I think the whole idea that, you know, we're like assuming that we're better than this, which is the Trump administration, and assuming that because it's, you know, the things that he said were so stupid, and, you know, and like, I think using this kind of ableist terminology of like, it's so dumb that it couldn't possibly be believed by anybody. And of course, you know, this is where we start to see like the phenomena of the echo chamber on Facebook, where like, if the only people that you're talking to have the exact same political beliefs as you, then of course you'll be blindsided by things like that.
Right.
And I have been blindsided by enough things like that in my life that I've tried to, you know, not let that happen in the future, just by, you know, trying to, I guess, be less naive in that regard myself.
Had you felt blindsided by this election? Because it is so interesting, depending on who I talk to, who kind of could see it coming like a freight train and who could not. And I would say it was partly a regional thing. So,
yeah, I think, I mean, the region certainly had something to do with it. Although, you know, like, never let it be said that the Northeast is free, you know, is free of guilt in this regard.
Oh,
you know,
no.
Like, as I drove, like, so I, one of my yearly gigs is a caroling gig, which takes me all over the state of Connecticut in Victorian outfit, singing Christmas carols and a few token Hanukkah songs in Victorian garb. And, you know, so that took me to places far outside of New Haven County, and seeing a lot of support for Trump, for Republicans there. And, you know, especially like in this kind of populist fashion. And like, you know, my mother lives in Greenfield, Massachusetts, which is a little outside what Colin McEnroe calls the tofu curtain, right? So like the kind of liberal shield of the Pioneer Valley. And, you know, just even there, like as long ago as 10 years ago, you know, was encountering some racism there firsthand. And like kind of, you know, people just looking for people to blame problems on, you know, especially because in that area in particular, there were way more jobs than there were people. And, you know, industry kind of dried up in the same way. I mean, this is a kind of age old story, I guess, but I was seeing it there for the first time, you know, in like the summer of 2007. And this was, you know, sort of the beginning, well, not the beginning, but like, this was a major waypoint in my journey to political awareness that is still happening, of course. But yeah, so I guess I was, but to bring it back to the song, like that, for me, I was, you know, already very wary of these kind of empty calls for solidarity and things that that seem to be somewhat more one-sided. So I guess in a sense, I was like trying to call that out a little bit. And I don't, you know, it didn't seem to be super hostile, but it was like, that was just what I was feeling, as much as I was this kind of weariness of the government and of, you know, of the administration and all that. So,
well, and then in reacting to the administration or kind of, you know, letting everything fly at you. So we're constantly bombarded. I think, you know,
they're
like, I'm rarely in a place where something isn't either playing or a news page isn't up. So maybe it's a computer, maybe it's a television, maybe it's a radio, but constantly hearing things. And so the flip side of this song is I'm really interested in what you do for comfort. And so I'll ask about comfort food, but also self-care. You know, what do you do to practice self-care?
I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot because I am the most guilty of anyone of, you know, doing self-care practices that are just kind of immediately comforting, if maybe not in the long term, the most bolstering thing. So, you know, I may eat a lot of junk food. I may, you know, like watch a lot of TV, you know, things like that, things that are more distractions than anything. But I, while recognizing that that's a super necessary part of being politically aware in this world, that you need to just not be thinking of those things 24/7, because it just the density of information out there would drive anybody nuts, I think. So.
Well, and then, okay, so then as far as, you know, what you put in your body for comfort, you know, tell me about those things, and then maybe we'll get into another recipe. So you said junk food, although if that, you know, includes like injera, that's not very junky. So
I'm a big fan of savory things. I mean, I'm always a little bit worse for wear when New Haven has a donut shop, which it currently does. So you know, I am a fan of things like that somewhat regularly, but yeah, I mean, I like salty snacks. You know, I generally, and to avoid eating lots of chips, I try and eat, you know, nuts, almonds, things like that. So things that are a little bit marginally healthier. I also, you know, I really like my, you know, for me, like just eating a really big meal is a, you know, kind of a nice thing. There's just like a moment where you can't possibly think about anything other than what you're eating or what you've just eaten. And that's, I think, a pretty valuable thing to just be in the present moment in that way and have, you know, having food be a conduit for that in some way.
And do you cook a lot as well?
I do.
Tell us about another recipe that you brought with you.
Or
sort of have up in your, I'm pointing to.
Yeah.
The head region.
So I mean, let's see. I don't really follow recipes that much. I do with recipes what some people do with history, which is like, you know, kind of cherry pick them and try and have a vision and, you know, try and check with the existing canon as to see if I can avoid making any mistakes that are really obvious. And sometimes I have to rewrite the history too a little bit because a first attempt may be pretty disastrous. But, so one of the things that I do a lot is if I eat a food that I am really intrigued by, I will do my best to try and replicate it at least some point.
Oh, that's very cool.
Usually what will happen is I'll make something that doesn't anywhere near hold a candle to what the source was that I ate. And it's usually from a restaurant. So in this case, the recipe that I'm thinking of right now is mushedra, which I first had, most convincingly from Aladdin's Crown Pizza, which a lot of people may think of as, you know, as kind of a junky, like pizza, you know, standard American, like Italian American fare pizza place. But, you know, they have like this whole, I believe Lebanese deli, I might be incorrect about that. But they have like a lot of really good Middle Eastern recipes that they do. And I think I would hesitate to say are a little better than, some of what like Mamoun's does or a lot of the competitors. And so I have my bias there, but it's a recipe that uses like green lentils. Traditionally it's made with bulgur, like cracked wheat, and just various spices, a lot of parsley, you know, the flavor palette kind of uses cinnamon, clove. So like things that are traditionally associated with sweeter foods, although in levels that it, you know, I don't taste the dish as right. being a sweet dish. A lot of olive oil. And then, you know, the kind of the big draw for me is that it has both on top and within, a whole bunch of caramelized shallots. Mm. So there's, you know, it's a really, I mean, it's the kind of thing where like it's very easy to make, if you have a process for it and it lasts for a really long time. So, you know, if it's like a really busy week, it's something you have lunch for a long time. It keeps well because of all the olive oil in it. And, you know, it's also something that I feel confident whipping up for like a, you know, like a garden party or a dinner party or something like that.
And lentils have fiber. So, mm-hmm. I mean, right there, it's super healthy protein, right? Fiber.
Yeah. I mean, when I make it, I'll use sweet brown rice, which just because the texture is somewhat similar, it's got that kind of chewiness that bulgur does, but then it's not as gluten-y. So
we were getting into self-care, and I wanted to ask about the things Matlock holds space for in his own life. He pulled out this.
This is a newer song. I'm one of those people who doesn't write songs that often, for a songwriter. So I guess new as in like summer of last year, is that's when it was, I started playing it. And it was heavily inspired by reading a Philip K. Dick novel called Counterclock World, which is one of his schlockier ones, but it had some really memorable imagery. So. Something in the way, something that is blocking the flow of time, something that is softening all the lines like chalk in rain. I was about to say that in the light of flickering neon signs, your face, it loses all its resemblance to mine, this city stain. Grow from piles of dust. I watch your wound undone. Your face takes back disgust. I thought this city was as good a place to die as any other one. A center of another sun. But there's something in the way. Something followed me in here. We wanted to escape, to pack a bag and take our six favorite things, a journal and a shirt and your uncle's ring, if time would allow. Put it all on tape, but trying to articulate obstacles is like trying to spin a sweater from unwashed wool. Would we be proud? It's enough to say we did not go. We got as far as Clara's house, right up the road, before we turned our targets toward each other's throats, and then unleashed a salvo that brought down the ghost. See that building crumble into dust, and watch that wound inflicted. See that fence post rust. Now who the hell said anyone could live in here? But if I'm choiceless, I'll try not to shed a tear. But there's something in the way. Oh, there's something in the way.
And what for you, what is that something in the way for you, you know, when you're writing?
Like as an obstacle to
yeah.
finishing? I mean, it's always time. It's always focus. I am restless creatively. So it's usually a matter of what project is holding my attention at any one time rather than trying to juggle them all.
And do you sort of have a lot of little projects maybe spread around that, you know, some get finished, some don't?
Yeah. And I do a reasonable job of juggling, of just like keeping track of them all, just because I take a lot of notes. I have like a couple of notebooks that if I lost, I'd be unmoored completely. But there, you know, it helps me to keep track of, you know, if it's been a long time since I've worked on this project, usually I'll have some notes that I've taken as of the last draft of something or, and that's a way for just for me to manage doing all this stuff. And I, you know, I don't, feel necessarily like I could give any one of them up at any point. So it better to cycle through them, I guess.
Do you feel like going back to those notes? Because I'm very similar. Like if I write it down, all of a sudden I feel better, even though nothing has changed.
Right.
Like you still have the task in front of you. So do you feel like that's your sort of your security blanket?
In a lot of ways, just to visualize things, because my brain races a lot. And so if there's less, you know, a lot of that is like a defense mechanism because I don't want to forget something. And it's happened enough times that I, you know, have come up with an idea, whether, you know, a melody or some way to approach something that already exists, you know, as far as a draft. And then I just can't remember it by the time I have a piece of paper in front of me. So, you know, between using sort of voice memos, like kind of recording things and keeping notebooks around, that's one way of just like having the confidence that like, if I totally space out and forget everything that I'm thinking about at this moment, at least I'll have something to jog my memory later on. So,
well, in the song you mentioned, you know, we'll grab, oh, I forget what it is, but our six favorite things.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have with you a favorite recipe? I'm curious.
Favorite recipe. Okay. So here's one of the few recipes that I actually use from a book regularly.
Oh my gosh. It's a song about a book. It's crazy.
So when I first moved to New Haven, which was over almost 10 years ago now, quickly discovered Bloodroot down in the Bridgeport area. And they have this great set of cookbooks that they produced at some major anniversary. I think their 30th, maybe. I went there, the food was tremendous, you know, like went there more than once and, you know, was really like really appreciated it. And finally, you know, got these cookbooks. And I was going to do the thing that I normally do with cookbooks, which is just kind of flip through them and, you know, like see if I can come up with an idea, but then not really follow the recipe. And I thought, like, you know, what would the people who founded Bloodroot do if they saw this dude just like flipping through and then just deciding he knew better than, you know, than what their recipe was?
Right, like dude being the operative word.
Exactly. Yes. So I thought, like, well, maybe just let the specter of the Bloodroot founders like kind of hang over me and guilt me into following a recipe for once. And I have made the best risotto that I, you know, because of that. So it's their risotto recipe, which is in, they have, you know, a vegetarian and a vegan edition. And this is from the vegan edition of their cookbook set. It's, you know, it's not a huge amount of ingredients, not a hugely complicated process. They don't advocate the whole stirring constantly method that a lot of other risotto, recipes call for. So it's just a matter of making sure that you have enough porcini mushrooms, making sure that you save the broth, all that stuff. It's not a super complicated procedure, but there's enough details that I always consult it before I make this recipe. So,
and have you subbed in different, you know, sometimes people learn to make a mushroom risotto and then they make it with peas instead or something like that. Have you subbed anything in, or do you just don't mess with it? It's like the bad feminist juju would come and kick your ass.
I don't think I've messed with it much. There have been points when I've really wanted to make it and maybe I haven't had one or two things. Mm. And so then I'll just try and make it without or figure out a substitution. But they have you serve the recipe. The main thing is that they have you serve the recipe with fried tempeh, so that you crumble it and fry it. And I know the texture of tempeh is kind of problematic for some, including my fiance who I'm living with right now. So I don't really use it these days, but I'll use something else, like some kind of lentil or, you know, something that fits the texture. So there's that.
I didn't want to let Matlock go before asking about his love for and growing expertise in klezmer music. So that's where we went next.
Let's see. I was a student at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, and in that school system, there's the five college consortium. So you can take classes at any one of the five colleges. There's two in Amherst, two in Northampton. No, two in Hadley. I can't remember now.
That's
sorry,
okay.
Three. Anyway, but yeah, there it's all kind of spread around over Northampton, South Hadley, and Amherst, Massachusetts. So this was a class that was at Mount Holyoke. You know, so I got on the bus with my friend, you know, every week, like once a week for this whole semester. And yeah, I mean, it really, I think I had been hearing a lot of sounds that were kind of like klezmer over the course of my life and just didn't really know what to call them. And I think at first I kind of lumped in, you know, sort of everything sort of east of Poland, pretty much, with klezmer music, mm-hmm. which of course I learned was not really the case. There's a lot of nuances that kind of separate these different national and regional and ethnic styles and whatnot. But you know, so at the time this was like this really invigorating thing because I'd never really played anything like this. I was playing this new instrument that I really fell in love with because it didn't require power. You know, like when I was in high school, I had to schlep around a huge keyboard and amplifier, and just like it was not fun. So this was like this really kind of freeing thing that got me away from the piano and like made it feel like I wasn't a failure for giving up on the piano at the point that I did. So that was another thing too.
And were you writing your own music at that point?
Almost. But it was pretty soon thereafter. Because I had gotten really interested in composition midway through my time at Hampshire, music composition. And so I kind of shifted things around to kind of change, to have that be my focus. So I was probably just starting to. And they weren't really inspired by klezmer per se, but that was a really big source of energy just as a performer and just performing for the first time in a really long time. So then I took the ensemble three times, and you know, I'm pretty sure I didn't get credit the second two, or I got the third time. It was just too much. But it was, you know, it was really great to just like keep doing it and like feel a certain amount of I don't know. It seemed like expertise at the time. And of course I'm still learning that that's not the case. But it was really great to just have something that was really invigorating and kept me practicing and all those things. So.
And then when you started writing, did you sort of say, oh, there's this cool thing that has been intriguing to me, I want to write about this, or there's this subject that I haven't been able to tackle in another area of my life, let's see if I can write a song about it.
I guess I started writing more sort of like composition, capital C composition type things, yeah, before I started writing songs. So one of the first things upon, you know, kind of switching gears into a music track was to take a songwriting class at Amherst College. And so that, and even that, you know, the three songs that I produced for that class, like some of them I still play, but it took me a really long time to get them done. And I think I was just really self-conscious about the lyrics. I was also doing sort of creative writing, fiction writing at the time, and was, you know, still thinking that that would be a pretty main part of a career or a, you know, a lifestyle for me. And it's not really anymore. And I think that songwriting has kind of taken the place of that because I'm really interested still in storytelling. But I don't have the patience to write long form, you know, short stories or novel. I've never written a novel. I don't feel like I quite have the discipline for that kind of thing. So I have much respect for people who do. But part of it was just needing to continue telling stories and not really, you know, having a steady outlet that felt reliable for me. So
our time is winding down, but I want to talk about Klez Canada.
Okay.
Which you just got back from like 2 nights ago.
Yeah. Sunday night.
So tell listeners about Klez Canada, because I think if you're in the klezmer community, like, mm-hmm. of course you know what it is. But if you're just a pleb like me, you have no idea what this is.
So for a week, you know, some of the most preeminent practitioners of klezmer, of Jewish music in general, are sort of teaching, leading workshops at this camp. And it's hosted at a Jewish summer camp in Lantier, Quebec. So it's about an hour northwest of Montreal, thereabouts. So it gets really cold at night. It's up in the mountains. It's kind of a magical experience. But I think it probably wouldn't be if you weren't already into klezmer, let's put it that way. Or if you weren't raised Jewish, I would imagine. Because it's also a cultural experience. It's not just like klezmer is very often understood as being kind of a secular music, but, since going there, and this was my fourth year going, I'm starting to understand how, like, you know, Yiddish culture is, in particular, like has a lot of connection to how klezmer is practiced.
Well, and Hampshire where the Yiddish Book Center
yes.
is? Yeah. So was that, you know, was that something that, because Hampshire is a very small school.
Mm-hmm.
And so did that enter into sort of your at least peripheral vision or maybe your focus when you were there as a student?
A bit, but not by any chance of my own, really. Okay. So they, let's see, at one point, the klezmer band that I was in at Mount Holyoke did a performance at the Yiddish Book Center. The Yiddish Book Center is not hugely thrilled, I think, to be associated with Hampshire College. I may be wrong about that, and I don't want to, you know, ruffle any feathers, but I this is my understanding that, like, you know, they don't really like mention that they're on Hampshire campus, right? Like the same way like the Eric Carle Museum does. So there, you know, I think there's, I honestly don't know like what the backstory is, but it was, you know, it was my understanding that you had to kind of go looking for it, as a Hampshire student.
Yeah. But the experience of sort of Judaism, because you're right in that Judaism is, I think for many, many people, certainly for me, as mm-hmm. cultural as it is, religious.
Yeah.
And spiritual and sort of the culture almost, I think for many people, the cultural part is almost more important than the spiritual part
yeah.
or they are one and the same.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, you know, is going to this part of that as well, going to this and playing. So Dave Chevin, who's in mm-hmm. the Afro-Semitic experience, often talks about how, he gets so angry at people who say he shouldn't play on Shabbat.
Hmm.
Because he doesn't think of it as irreverent in any way. He thinks of it as sort of his own way of praying and his own way of consecrating the Sabbath and welcoming the Sabbath.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak with any authority on that, but they just from being at Klez Canada and then, you know, having been invited to a few like Shabbat dinners and doing occasionally a Seder, like, my experience is that there's like a real multitude of ways to do that sort of reverence, you know, and it could just be like getting trashed and like singing for 5 hours at the Tish, right? So there could be that, or it could be,
yeah.
you know, just like, just having like a real communion with close friends or chosen family or something like that. So, you know, I think there's a real multitude of ways to go about that. Just from what I've seen, and I'm glad to have been a part of that in some way. I think at generally there are enough Orthodox people at Klez Canada that at the very least on Friday night, you know, there's no classes, no concert, or anything like that. So it's just much more about the community at that point rather than just the musicianship.
Did you grow up in a spiritual household? Was that part of growing up for you?
It was. In very different ways. So I guess, you know, my mom came up in like African Methodist Episcopal Church. My dad came up with the, you know, the very like Anglican Episcopal kind of thing. Well, he came up Baptist. And so then like his way of rebelling was to join a Catholic seminary. And he realized pretty soon that that was not for him. And, you know, by the time we moved back to the States, he was working for the Episcopal Diocese of Western Mass. So that, you know, I went to Episcopal churches growing up. That was like a big thing for me. And I thought of myself as being pretty religious until high school, when that kind of irreverence really just sort of creeps in. So.
And then on the flip side, when you were kind of opening yourself up to klezmer and playing in klezmer ensembles, and then certainly, you know, going to like musical happenings,
retreats
like Klez Canada, you know, is there also that kind of Stammtisch culture that that in some ways was endemic to the Germany of your very early youth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you experience that where there is, you're just sitting around a table and you like, you play, you know, and sometimes you're improvising, sometimes you know what you're playing, but it goes on for hours and hours and hours.
I guess, yeah, there has been a little bit of that sort of since getting into klezmer. I would say that having a better sense of the overall, you know, like particular, you know, of Yiddishkeit, right, which is more like distinct from like Israeli culture, right. You know, in particular, like it has helped my understanding of how to play and understand klezmer a little bit, and in really subtle ways. Like, you know, I'm not sure that I could like academically come up with those distinctions. So I think that, you know, there's a bit of how, you know, just getting a little bit of immersion in that, it like has, you know, has really helped my understanding to some degree. And, you know, and just again, like kind of seeing the plurality has helped me to understand klezmer as the sort of mutable thing that it is now. Because I think what it is, you know, there's a different definition every few years, it seems like. So,
and have you found that food is part of that? Because I also know that there's a resurgence. So certainly in, I don't want to just say Jewish millennials, but mm-hmm. in younger Jewish adults, there's been a resurgence of Yiddish, like mm-hmm. learning Yiddish, yeah. not learning Hebrew.
Right.
And, you know, and with that sort of comes the whole kit and caboodle, which includes food and mm-hmm. people saying, oh, my grandmother made this. I want to learn how to make it.
Mm.
Do you find that that sort of enters into the bigger klezmer sphere?
It can. I guess that's a good question. I'm not, you know, I like, for example, before going to Klez Canada 4 years ago, I had not ever had gefilte fish before. Mm. So that's, you know.
Oh, that is a life experience, Adam.
It sure is. And, you know, it probably because it's happening at a camp, right, you know, rather than somebody's home kitchen, like with, you know, family recipes and all that stuff, that, you know, I think there's a lot of people there who are like, you know, I'm sorry that this is your first gefilte fish, right? You know, this could be so much better. So yeah, I mean, I guess that there it's more through other like sort of personal connections, and you know, have I sort of started to see that a little bit more, just in terms of like, you know, like eating someone's best attempt at making their grandmother's borscht recipe or something like that. So I don't know. That's a very good question.
So as we wind down, I want to ask for, you know, the recipe that you would leave readers, that you would leave listeners with, sort of your desert island recipe. If someone said, I know that I want to make this, or I need to have something in my back pocket, you know, what would that be?
That's a very good question. Probably the most consistent thing, like my sort of go-to comfort food / easy thing to make, because it can get paired with a lot of other things, is this one of the first things that I learned to make, which was the aglio olio e peperoncini, which is, you know, like apparently in certain parts of Italy more common than tomato sauce, right? And it's literally just you know slow cook in a lot of olive oil, some garlic, and if you're not vegetarian, you know, you might put in a whole anchovy or two, and just, you know, simmer it at a pretty low heat until the anchovy starts to dissolve, until the garlic is very lightly browned, and just pour that over pasta. And that, yeah, I mean, that, so that was one of the first recipes where, even though it was super easy, I learned how to quality control, because if you burnt the garlic, didn't taste very good. And, you know, and I also had to develop a taste for anchovies, which happened largely thanks to the anchovies that they use at Delenia. So, which are, you know, like they're meatier anchovies or something, rather than what, you know, the kind of like just mostly skin and bones that people associate with anchovies. So that's kind of the reliable thing for me, is just, you know, doing that with pasta. You can saute a vegetable in the oil that's left, you know, or like a green or broccoli or something. And it just makes a pretty easy meal that, again, doesn't feel like it's going to leave you the worse for wear. So,
and then, of course, did you bring a desert island song?
Yeah. So this song is also kind of an older song. It was written on the occasion of a punk house in New Haven, kind of drying up a little bit, so it basically everybody moved out of it, and then they started to renovate the house and charge more money for it, so the landlords did. So it's called Coffee Mouse, and that title has stuck, and it's just kind of a tale of dumpster diving and after the apocalypse, I guess. Puddle of a rat makes my feet stick to the floor. It's crawling like an urban stream. These walls are breeding fruit flies and roaches. There's gotta be a nest somewhere behind the seams. A stench is buried somewhere beneath these boards, and plastic keeps the poison on the other side. So many have tried to stay awake for the score, but after 20 hours feel like they could die. The mouse will find some coffee for us to drink. The upside of the death of the atmosphere. It's been a while since we've seen ice or snow. A nuclear winter's not really a winter. There's poison on the wind, but no cold can blow. A mouse is grinding coffee between its teeth. It's grown 6 feet or more since the bombs first hit. We haven't had power since the end of the war. The mouse tolerates us. We can't live without it. A mouse will grind our coffee this morning. Wake up, house! Wake up, house, you're cruising. Come outside, scavenge for our choosing. Wake up, house, you're cruising. Come outside, scavenge for our choosing. Find a stash of coffee and run home to celebrate. In 20 years or more, when we can breathe the air, when the clouds can part and the trees are blush, will we build this house with mycelial shields? With mycelial shields, we'll be sealed, go lush. There are animals in curious poses. There are cities buried deep into the earth. There are great graveyards brimming with memories, and we'll remember what it was worth. A mouse will find some coffee for us to cultivate. Wake up, house! Wake up, not to war with. Come outside, we will create your. Wake up, house, nothing left to war with. Come outside, we will create your man. We had better tell it right this time. Wake up, house, nothing left to war with. Come outside, we will create your. Tell it right this time.